It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Welcome to the Monday edition of Balance of Power. I'm Joe Matthew in Washington, where we have reached peak bloom. Pay no attention to what's happening or not. In the case of Capitol Hill, the cherry blossoms have reached stage six. It's 60-something degrees outside. The tourists are clogging our streets, and spring is at hand in Washington. The question is, will the government shut down on Friday, even if for a minute? The chance of a possible stumble into a shutdown may have just gotten greater. We've been talking, of course, about a couple of solutions here that might include a continuing resolution for the Department of Homeland Security. That's where they had a sticking point there when it comes to border language, how to deal with border agents, border security, and the rest. We can't get past anything having to do with the border without an argument. And so here we are. We thought we might get text tonight. Now it appears we may not. And if that is the case, we could have a scenario in which we just bump into that shutdown midnight on Friday because they can't get everything done in time. And that's where we want to start the conversation with Eric Wasson reporting over the weekend and just hearing now from some lawmakers as we wait for the return of the House. It's good to see you, Eric. What kind of odds are we putting on this here? Because this DHS bill seems to be a problem.
You know, it's really touch and go. I keep hearing from sources yesterday on Sunday that it was coming out soon, then it wasn't. And then today as well, we were expecting it, and now it seems like it's not, but I just heard from a source that it may still come out. So we're not there yet, but things are difficult. It's six parts of this package, funding everything from the Pentagon to the Department of Education, but one part of it is the Homeland Security bill, which has been really the big sticking point between Congress and the Biden administration on border. This wouldn't solve the border policy dispute, remain in Mexico and all of that, but it would. They were trying to, you know, increase the number of detention beds for ICE, for example, increase border patrol funding. But, you know, they're kind of in a deadlock here. So I think it may still come out. But as you noted, the House has this procedure, must wait 72 hours. And that could be waived. It was waived in the case of a CR, of stopgap bill. If it's not, this pushes the Senate right up against the deadline. And we know things can move lightning fast with unanimous consent in the Senate, but they also can drag out. So, yeah, we could see a weekend shutdown, which some sources say is not such a bad thing. Or they could pass a three-day CR. I think this will get resolved. There's been hangups about these detention beds and so forth before. The appropriations committees know how to resolve this problem, but it's so inflamed at the president and speaker level that maybe we do stumble into a shutdown.
Well, I guess it's inevitable at some point, right? My God, I don't know if I've lost count. This would be our fifth CR if we actually needed one, I think. If you're dancing on the edge this, eventually you're going to fall off, right?
I think so, but it's still late towards the election year, so really people don't like to mess around with that so close to a time when voters may remember and assign blame. And the speaker has, and House Republicans have really decided that they're not going to kind of provoke a shutdown, doing everything they can to avoid it. Now, they won't sign on to something such as green lighting Biden migration policies that could get them in trouble with their base. But, if they can score some kind of policy wins here, I think it's going to go through.
Fascinating. So we've got a lot to learn, I guess, over the next couple of days here. If there is a shutdown, Eric, it's going to be something very short is the idea, right? We're actually a lot closer to finishing this in the end. It would almost be an accidental shutdown if this happens. Or are there some lawmakers who want to make a point?
There always are some that are advocating a shutdown, especially in the House Freedom Caucus, but they're kind of marginalized here. They're not really central to the mm-hmm. discussion. And again, there's been a law passed recently that even those non-essential workers who are furloughed will get paid. So that is a waste of money for the government for work paying for work that wasn't done. But those workers will eventually get paid for sure now. It was always an open question before this law was passed. The essential workers work and they don't get the pay right away, but they'll get it later. So it's really a question of contracts and others. But a weekend shutdown probably doesn't have a big impact on many people and certainly doesn't have an impact on the economy.
Well, let's see what we can do this week. Eric Wasson, great to see you. Welcome back to the fray here with the countdown that'll bring us to midnight Friday. Once again, we'll see if we can get this done. And of course, if you listen to this program, you will know long before it happens. I'm Joe Matthew in Washington. As we spin a couple of plates here, this would typically be a pretty quiet period of time on a Monday like this, the 18th of March. But we've got a lot to talk about with not only a potential shutdown this late in the game in the fiscal year, but just an endless string of headlines coming from Israel. And we just got another important one here as Joe Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu have held their first call, we have just learned, in more than a month. This, of course, against the backdrop of some very difficult policy and politics with regard to Israel and Gaza that have dogged this president here on the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue when it comes to progressive Democrats on Capitol Hill and also on the campaign trail with an uncommitted vote, a protest vote that has followed him through states like Michigan and Minnesota. Interesting, yesterday, St. Patrick's Day, the president and the prime minister of Ireland, the Taoiseach, together for a St. Patrick's Day dinner at the White House for what would normally be a very fun celebration. And this was very much in the air. The Taoiseach explained why Ireland has such a long history of supporting and backing the Palestinians in this case. They both acknowledge the need for aid, and we want to talk a bit about the risks that come with that. It's a conversation we were having in our newsroom, the idea of not only airdropping supplies, but also setting up a temporary port or pier is fraught with risk, and this is why this would be done by the military in part. Kelly Grieco is with a senior fellow at the Reimagining Grand Strategy Program at the Stimson Center. Kelly, welcome back to Bloomberg. It's great to have you. There are a lot of questions still about whether we can pull this off, knowing that we don't want to put U.S. boots on the ground to make this temporary pier work. Is it still the best option we have?
Well, first, thank you for having me. As you said, this is a really challenging time with what's happening in Gaza and the humanitarian crisis. You know, the question you asked, is this the best option? Well, no, it's not the best option in the sense that there are trucks, you know, in Egypt right now that are loaded and ready to go to into Gaza. Sure. But as long as that is blocked as an option, we need to find potentially some way to bring in a greater volume of aid than is possible through airdrops.
Mm-hmm. We've heard criticism of this idea from both sides of the aisle. And we know that a couple of trucks, the second aid truck has now arrived on a shipment, rather, have arrived on Gaza's shore. I shouldn't say truck, but a second a ship has. To the extent that we can build a temporary pier, how would that work if we don't want to have American boots on the ground?
Yeah, so I think it's important to say that there are really two things that need to be constructed for this operation. One is to actually construct a floating dock, which would be a little bit further out of sea so that large cargo ships could pull up to that dock and unload their cargo. And then it would then be transferred to smaller ships that would then be headed towards what would be the second thing that needs to be constructed, which is a floating pier and causeway. And that would be where those things would then be unloaded and then trucks would then take it and distribute it to Gazans. So you need to construct both of those. Of course, the question a lot of people have is, how do you construct a pier without U.S. forces being put on the ground? And the way to do that is you construct it at sea, and then you essentially drive it in to connect with the land. So yes, it, technically, there are not troops on the ground.
Do we have any reason to believe that Israel would stop this from happening? What if Israel doesn't want this here.
Yeah, I mean, I think if Israel doesn't want this, I don't see how this is viable because, frankly, at least in some of the reporting, it seems to be that the Israelis are going to provide an outer security perimeter. And that would be key for two reasons. One, because, of course, there would be concerns about attacks from Hamas or some other kind of actor on the infrastructure and forces at sea. And then the second piece would also be that, you know, these are people in Gaza that are desperate. They're going to rush towards the aid. It's understandable, but it creates a really dangerous security situation. And so you would need some presence on the ground providing security. And so that, in this case, has to be the Israelis.
We have a trust problem here when the World Central Kitchen, which is behind these shipments, says 200 tons of aid was on board, and the IDF says it was 115 tons. We have a problem here, right?
Yes. I mean, I don't know what accounts for the difference or how they're making their calculations. But I would say, you know, 200 tons, it's not nothing, you know, to scoff at, but it is actually pretty small compared to what the actual needs are. And that ship, for example, stopped at a barge, a smaller barge, because it's a smaller ship. You know, I think the question is, again, the kind of volumes that are required requires an ability to bring in much larger ships. And so I think you're raising the right issue, which is, you know, is Israel going to allow that and have concerns about what's on these ships, for example?
As we spend time with Kelly Grieco from the Stimson Center, I'm Joe Matthew in Washington. This phone call, I assume, is going to lead to some settlement of these questions today. President Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu talking about specifically the issue of delivering aid, but also managing an invasion of Rafah. And I wonder your thoughts on that. With your expertise in this field, is it possible for the IDF to actually get civilians out of the way? That, of course, is the Hamas strategy, right, to use them as human shields.
Yes. I mean, I think it's really difficult. I think we sometimes we have the answer because we've seen throughout the course of the operations of Israel making announcements for civilians to go places. And then it's just really hard, given how the concentration of population, to sort of clear these areas from any kind of civilians. And this is the reality, I think of war. I think the more interesting thing to me will be, you know, Biden publicly declared it a red line around Rafah in terms of wanting a plan to protect civilians, and whether, you know, the president is now on board with that Israeli plan, or if he's actually going to take a much harder position now. And try to put pressure on the Israelis to move in a different direction, use leverage that we have, which is largely our military aid to Israel.
We've spoken a lot, of course, about Israel in this case, but as well, funding for the war in Israel. It's tied to funding for the war in Ukraine, Kelly, and it's still hung up in Washington, even as the president tries to move this needle. It's just not been happening lately, and it's created a real concern in Ukraine as they run out of ammunition. I know this is also something that you've got your eyes on. And after hearing from Vladimir Putin over the weekend, reelected in air quotes at 87%, I believe it was, he talked about cutting Ukrainian troops to pieces. And I wonder to what extent this election will embolden him to try to finish the job.
Yes. I mean, I think one of the things that we should be looking at to see is if he's going to now feel confident enough to announce another partial mobilization. You know, I think there's signs that that might indeed be the case. And I think that actually creates real challenges for Ukraine. On the one issue that they have control over, they may not have control over, you know, ammunition coming from the West or other kinds of weapons, but they do have control over their mobilization. And right now, bills are hung up in their own government about trying to mobilize more of their population. And so that's my concern, is really the shortage in personnel.
But of course, if we look at the equipment side as well, if this money were passed today in Washington, when would we actually be able to make the shells and deliver them?
Yeah, so I mean, the United States has ramped up ammunition production quite a bit since the start of the war. And by 2025, the Army has said that they'll be able to produce 100 rounds of these 155 millimeter shells per month. So I think actually in terms of things like ammunition, we probably can continue right now to provide that to Ukraine and quickly. The issue becomes harder when we start talking about some of these systems that are more expensive and that we don't have as many numbers, like missiles for the Patriot systems that we've sent to Ukraine, ATACMs. These are these long range missile systems. Those things, there would need to be time. And we're really coming down to numbers here where I don't actually see how we're able to send much more to Ukraine without endangering, you know, our own stocks.
Kelly Grieco, thank you. It's great to have you back from the Stimson Center.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
After another wild weekend, I hope you had a great St. Patrick's Day. Wild on the campaign trail, or at least in terms of some of the rhetoric that we heard. And that means it is now time for us to debate the context of the term bloodbath. If you weren't paying attention over the weekend, I salute you. Maybe you had a holiday to celebrate. But Donald Trump is floating this idea. We'll give it to you in his words, and we will give you the context of a 100% tariff on EVs from China. It was what he said after that, because that would be quite a story on any day. But beyond the tariff, it was the language that he chose. And some news organizations, you know, they cut that right down to a narrow soundbite, and it got everybody upset. Let's hear it in full. This is Donald Trump on the campaign trail over the weekend. Listen.
If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it.
All right, there you go. It's going to be a bloodbath. It's going to be the least of it. Now, there's been an urging by Republicans, as I heard, and some Democrats all throughout the day, Sunday morning television and on the news programs, that context is everything here. Slow down, mainstream media. But I guess the question is there a good context for a bloodbath? Let's assemble the panel. Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano join on a Monday. Back from the weekend, our signature panel. Rick, pull me in off the ledge here. Are we making too much of this?
You know, I don't think we're making too much of it, but I'm not exactly sure we're talking about the right thing. You know, the one thing that I think gets missed by the media, and it's been a big problem since the 2020 elections, is the proliferation of political violence. And no more a great example of it than in my old stomping grounds in Arizona. Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, one of the biggest counties in America, the hotbed for political wins and losses in Arizona. And last week, the Board of Supervisors, the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, was attacked in their chambers during a meeting by Trump supporters screaming revolution. And this is an attack on government. And they took over the podium. The supervisors got out by a side door, called the sheriff's office, cut off the live feed. And this is the context with which our top politician in the Republican Party is talking about bloodbaths. Now, I don't really care what the context is, whether it's about cars or whether it's about the country, but it's not the kind of terminology that I think we ought to be using in a country that is already rift with political violence. And the last thing he said, which wasn't in your clip, is that it's going to be a bloodbath for the country. And so I'm just trying to piece together, like, so, okay, so we don't have any Chinese EVs coming in because of his tariff. Why is that a bloodbath for the country? I don't get it.
I don't.
If he loses. So anyway, I think it's all about context. I think that we need to be very focused on political violence, and this kind of hot rhetoric doesn't help.
Well, that was awfully well answered. Jeannie, it seems like this kind of stuff should be acknowledged. There is a normalizing after a while of, you know, what I think Donald Trump calls it, locker room talk or something like that. But it seems to me that the context might be irrelevant here. How about you?
Well, I happen to agree with that. I think anytime we are trying to contextualize or understand or decipher or channel what Donald Trump is talking about, we have to take a step back and ask ourselves, does it really matter? He himself long ago said he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't matter. He can say almost anything at this point and it doesn't matter to his voters. And I think rather than asking what he means or what he was saying, or was he talking about automobile tariffs, or was he talking about another January 6th, we're better off asking, why doesn't this matter to his voters? And there is a really solid research base for answering that question. It doesn't matter to his voters because his voters have long felt left out and left aside and pushed away by both parties. So they're not asking for an answer to their economic problems. They are asking, quite frankly, for a middle finger to the establishment. And that's what Donald Trump provides. So they're in on all his jokes, his rhetorics, the more vulgar, the better. And so from this perspective, contextualizing what he says doesn't matter. We should be focusing instead on what he's proposing. And 100% tariff on automobiles is a big proposal with enormous ramifications. That should have been the news, not the use of the term bloodbath.
Well, thank you both for being thoughtful on that. I'll tell you, there are some folks with a lot of money who are giving a middle finger back to Donald Trump. In this case, those who gave Joe Biden $53 million in February. This went to the reelection campaign and the party. That's a record for the month. Rick, the campaign has $155 million cash on hand, the most amassed for a Democrat at this point in the calendar. How do you read that, knowing that polling has been such a problem for him?
Yeah, look, I mean, he's got one of the essential elements of a successful campaign, a financial advantage. Now, most incumbents running for reelection are going to have a financial advantage, but this has been a year where we've understood that it's basically two incumbents running against each other. And Donald Trump's been fundraising since the day he left office. And the fact that he's spent down his wad of cash, and not insignificantly because of his legal problems, indicates a real functional problem for Donald Trump. He probably doesn't need to equal or exceed Biden's spending to be competitive. Obviously, he's ahead in the polls right now in these targeted states. But the campaign between the two of them has just really begun. And the reality is he cedes this ground, this financial turf to Biden is very dangerous. I don't know any candidate who thinks that's a good idea. And so, you know, kudos to the Democrats for hustling and getting a lot of money in. And I think that there are real concerns within the Republican Party about whether or not Donald Trump is equipped to financially manage his campaign. There's no question that the RNC is a part of his problem now. He's now running the RNC and it doesn't have any money. His campaign's basically broke and he's got all these bills coming in from lawyers. So it's a big problem.
It's a big problem, Jeannie, when Donald Trump says it is a practical impossibility. That is a quote from the court filing to post full bond while he appeals the penalty, $454 million penalty against him in New York's civil fraud case. He says doing so may require cash reserves nearing $1 billion. We still have 8 months left of this campaign, right? We've been talking about the longest ever and likely most expensive ever general election campaign. And Joe Biden is sitting on more money than a Democrat has ever had at this point. Are we having the right conversation about this race?
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, he had the strongest fundraising amongst the grassroots, I think, ever in modern American history. But that number could be that could be wrong, but it was a strong one. So, you know, to echo what Joe Biden has been saying, you know, you look at those polls and you feel that, you know, he's widely unpopular at about 38%. But he counters and says, look at the fundraising we are doing. And it is not all from wealthy donors. A lot of it is from the grassroots. So there is enthusiasm out there for the campaign. But the reality is, as you know, we constantly talk about Trump's rhetoric and just what we were talking about before, the question is going to be, does it even matter? I mean, Trump is a master of the free media. He goes out over the weekend, says something almost undecipherable, and that's all we hear about. So, you know, traditionally, I would agree the money would matter an awful lot. But the reality is Donald Trump has really mastered this game of free media. He may continue to. So Joe Biden's going to be helped by this number for sure. But, you know, you have to ask how much, and can he overcome these slagging poll numbers in the Bloomberg poll in these key states where he is just consistently been behind, increasingly so, Donald Trump.
Well, let's grab the third rail for a moment here, Rick Davis, because Donald Trump did over the weekend. He was asked on Fox about this New York Times report that he was about to settle on a 6-week pregnancy ban, an abortion ban after 16 weeks, knowing that this number has been batted around a lot on the campaign trail. He says, we're going to find out, and pretty soon I'm going to be making a decision. Quote, I would like to see if we could make both sides happy, unquote. This is the man who takes credit for ending Roe v. Wade. How important will his answer be on this?
It's an incredibly dangerous thing to set up for yourself, right? And this is the thing that I, head-scratching moment, Joe. Why is he even taking that on himself? Why doesn't he just say, hey, there's these guys, you know, DeSantis, he's too short. You know, I'd like the way Youngkin did it. I mean, like, let those guys take the heat. He's already got the pro-life vote in his pocket. The only thing he can do is upset them. And if he picks a number that they don't like, you know, quote, trying to make everybody happy, then I think it's a problem for him. It is a very clear tell that he's worried about this abortion issue, because otherwise, why is he bringing it up?
I'd like to see if we could make both sides happy. Jeannie, I don't know how he would manage to do that. Is another option he never answers that question?
Yeah, that's another option. As we know, Donald Trump is, you know, probably the biggest stumbling block to his own campaign are the things that he says and does repeatedly. Abortion is something that he has taken credit for, the overturning of Roe, on a repeated basis. If it wasn't for Donald Trump, we wouldn't have had the overturning of Roe, and he has said that consistently. So now he is going to raise this. And it's an issue that has only helped the Democrats and the pro-choice side. So I'm not sure why he's raising it. I am sure his campaign doesn't want him to. But as usual with Donald Trump, they can't stop him. He's his own worst enemy in these situations.
You know, we haven't talked enough about Joe Biden in this instance outside of his financial situation. Jeannie, the matter of Israel followed him all weekend. It came up with the Prime Minister of Ireland at the St. Patrick's Day dinner, typically a very lighthearted affair. And news broke today, since we've been on the air, that he did have the first call in a month with Benjamin Netanyahu. How important is it going to be for him to have something to show for that call?
You know, I don't know that he's going to be able to do anything with a phone call to Netanyahu to assuage the really, really vocal protesters on the Democratic side. I do think it is critically important as president of the United States that he keeps those channels open. He has a consistent conversation. He assures Israel of our support for them as a close ally. This is the difficulty of being an incumbent. He's got to both, you know, speak to this base that is very unhappy, and he's got to run the country. And that is a difficult thing to do. So I don't know how he is going to make this that much better in the short term, unless we hear that there is indeed some type of ceasefire that he can take some credit for.
This has been close to a breakdown in communications, Rick. At one point, Joe Biden was quoted to say, you hug Benjamin Netanyahu, the more problem you have, the closer you hug him. And there hasn't been so many hugs lately here. It's become a political liability for Joe Biden. In our minute remaining, I'd ask you the same. Does he need to start showing more results from these calls?
Yeah, look, I mean, they don't have a lack of communication. They just have a disagreement. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu is proceeding upon a path that he believes is good for the people of Israel and good for his own political future. And Joe Biden's trying to minimize the carnage and bring Israel back into the world. Those are two things that right now stand in contrast to one another. And until they start to get closer to a center, that's going to be a disagreement that's going to last a long time.
A tour de force with Rick and Jeannie. I love this. We should do this every Monday.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
If it's Monday, it means we're about to start another week here in Washington, although technically lawmakers aren't really starting it yet. They're not.
Yeah, it's only Monday.
Today, it's only Monday. And yet Friday, Joe, is a very important deadline when you're trying to keep a spending equivalent of about 75% of the U.S. government open beyond midnight at the end of this week. And that's looking difficult as we begin the week, or kind of, here in Washington.
Yeah, I wonder, is this a working weekend for Jack Fitzpatrick? I bet he got some rest on St. Patrick's Day. He, of course, covers appropriations for Bloomberg government. And boy, that has become quite the beat for any reporter in Washington. That used to be a boring job, I think, at one point. Great to see you back. Jack, it strikes me that if you dance on the edge long enough, eventually you're going to fall off here. Even with best intentions, they try to get this thing done. They might actually bump into the deadline this weekend.
Yes. I mean, it's never a boring beat for me, but it is especially tense this year. As you mentioned, this is the bigger deadline. We've been talking about them struggling with funding the government for a while, but this is the one that includes the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. This is a little more than three quarters of the money. They really wanted a deal to come together by yesterday because they've got the 72-hour rule in the House. If a deal came together right now, we'd be talking about maybe a Thursday afternoon vote in the House. That gives the Senate very little time before Friday night. We already know that the Senate would need unanimous consent to hold a vote in time.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of bowling pins in the air that they're trying to juggle to get something done. And I think we're at the point where they have not said they are talking about another stopgap, but logistically they'll probably have to start talking about at least a short one if it doesn't come together right now.
And when we say short one, we're probably talking just a number of days, right, to actually get the legislation across the finish line, not another two-tiered something that kicks the can for a few weeks.
Another big one would be a tough sell because Republicans, continuing resolution, CR used to be a term of art. Now that is a dirty word for conservatives. They do not want to vote on a CR again. Last time when they struggled with the deadline, they talked about, well, if we need like a two-day stopgap, we could do that. That would probably be the conversation if it doesn't come together with a real deal just about immediately.
So this is why we can't have nice things. The language from Speaker Johnson makes me wonder, maybe you can bring us inside this debate over border spending a little bit. We're working toward a deal, he said, that reprioritizes DHS funding towards enforcing border and immigration laws. They rejected a $1.5 billion border security proposal here. What do they want?
Well, it's the same kind of issue that held up the foreign aid funding issue, the broader immigration negotiations. Republicans have said that the president keeps asking for money that, yes, would go to the Department of Homeland Security, but it's more for processing people through the system. Conservatives do not believe they're doing enough to dissuade people from coming here in the first place. You can talk about the Remain in Mexico policy or, you know, a variety of policies that would dissuade people from coming here and seeking asylum, stop people from crossing the border illegally.
So they want
they haven't
HR2.
Seen enough. Yeah, they want HR2. They wanted HR2 before. I'm sure the conversations have narrowed down to something shy of HR2. But when they thought they would need to do a stopgap just for Homeland Security, because they did talk about just a full year stopgap, they said, well, there would need to be some exceptions. Once they talked about the exceptions for border security, they realized that's the tough thing to negotiate, so they might as well try to negotiate the whole bill. So they're back at the age-old problem now of what do you do on border security that feels like real border security to the most conservative members who are willing to vote to fund the government.
So could we be in a situation where because they're facing down the threat of a shutdown of much wider parts of the government than just DHS, because all of this is getting roped together, Republicans actually have to give some of the border measures and a potentially a win to the Biden administration on them by this for that reason rather than giving them the win earlier on in the bipartisan deal that was negotiated.
You know, it's hard to define what a win would be to the Biden administration because this is an issue that's been pushed by conservatives. It's more been a question of how much of a win is enough for them to vote for it. They pushed the Biden administration in a more conservative direction on some of these asylum policies, but it wasn't enough for the conservatives. We've gotten to the point where a lot of people are kind of going in circles about how much of a win is something for us to really call a victory, and how much is too small so that we want to be able to run on this. That, you know, the shadow of Donald Trump is still hanging over anything with the border.
All right, Jack Fitzpatrick of Bloomberg Government, going to be a fun week for you, and hopefully
just
not weekend, I'm sure.
Four deadlines. That's coming someday, right? Oh. Four funding deadlines.
Don't wish that upon us.
I picture Jack waking up in a cold sweat with
please.
That when I read about that one. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Jack. And of course, he raises the specter of former President Trump, who we know has had some influence in the minds of those on Capitol Hill, specifically when it comes to the issue of border policy. Yep. He was not in favor of that bipartisan deal that was struck, and then that bipartisan deal very quickly died in this Congress. And of course, the former president, Joe, was in the news for other reasons over this weekend as well.
That's
speaking
for sure.
in Ohio about a bloodbath, but specifically he was talking about the auto industry. It's become about context in the aftermath.
That's what they say. We were debating in our previous hour whether there is a debate around context and whether there is any difference when it comes to a bloodbath.
Yes.
You want to hear what he said?
We
in the,
should
the
hear
four
from
months.
The former president this weekend.
If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it.
And then, of course, we got a follow-up on True Social after this.
Yeah, what did he write this morning?
Actually,
a lot of people are probably at work by the time that happened.
In part, the fake news media and their Democratic partners in the destruction of our nation pretended to be shocked at the use of my use of the word bloodbath, even though they fully understood I was simply referring to imports allowed by crooked Joe Biden, which are killing the automobile industry, is the quote from True Social.
I still don't get the why a bloodbath would be better if it were over cars. It's still a bloodbath.
Well, I guess it raises a question of how this is received in Ohio and in the Republican base to which he was probably speaking.
Well, yeah, this is a big reason why he was there. It is primary day tomorrow.
It is. And maybe it matters less if you've already locked up the Republican nomination, but there are down ballot implications in Ohio at stake in the primary tomorrow. And that is where we want to begin now with Spencer Kimball. He is the executive director of the Emerson College Polling Center, who just this hour has fresh data out
this
on
hour.
That Republican primary. Came out at 1 p.m. Eastern time. And Spencer, great to have you with us as this is breaking here. So your final poll of the Republican primary, this is for the Senate race in particular, 38% of voters likely to support Bernie Moreno, who wasn't leading in your polling just 5 days ago. This has been a pretty volatile primary race thus far. Tell us more about what you're finding now that we're just one day out.
Well, Kaylee, I think you got it right in that this race has really jumped around. We had Frank LaRose, the Secretary of State, leading this race back in November. And then Matt Dolan had the lead, as you mentioned, last week. But Trump's rally this weekend seems to have given Moreno a bit of a bump in our polling coming into today with a 10-point lead now.
A 10-point lead. So to Kaylee's point, just a week ago, this entire race was reverse of what we have now. So Moreno at 38%, Dolan at 29%, LaRose at 12%. This is all about Trump then?
Yeah, this race has been interesting. If you look at that number of undecided voters, when we started off, it was at 50%. And even this weekend when we're polling, it was at 20%. But we didn't let those undecided voters off the hook in our polling. We pushed them into who would they actually choose. And that's where we see a bump for Dolan. So that 9-point, 10-point gap tightens to 4 to 5 points when we push these undecided voters, that 20%, suggesting that this race could tighten tomorrow on Election Day.
So it'll be a very interesting day indeed. Are voters discriminating issue-wise between the different individuals here? Are voters who are likely to vote for Moreno prioritizing something over the others?
Yeah, that's the immigration policy issues and economy. Those two break for Moreno. He's leading those voters. If you got into topics like education or healthcare, well, then Dolan is actually leading with like 70%. But the problem for Dolan is those issues are only top issues for about 4 or 5% of Republican primary voters. Immigration and the economy, they're combined for about 75% as the most important issue. So that gives Moreno a good position, at least on those two issues.
We're talking with Spencer Kimball from Emerson College Polling. Of course, this is the primary to find out who's going to run against Senator Sherrod Brown. A very important seat for Democrats, Spencer. And fascinating, in your most recent poll, you found out that he's actually doing pretty well, strangely, with Trump supporters. 8% of Trump voters plan to split their ticket and vote for Brown. So what kind of a situation is he in? This was said to be the political fight of his life.
Well, he's certainly in a dogfight. Depends on who gets the nomination. In our polling, he seems to run better against Moreno at this point than he does against Dolan in a general election. But what we're seeing in Ohio is very similar to what we're seeing in Arizona, Nevada, Montana, Pennsylvania, where Trump is leading against Biden, and yet all of these Democratic Senate candidates are leading their Republican challengers by 2 to 3 points, even in a state like Montana, where Trump is up by 15, 16 points. So we'll see if that ticket splitting survives, you know, the fall. But that's what we're seeing at this time.
Well, and Spencer, that's what's so interesting is because here in Washington, the entire conversation about the balance of the Senate seems to be centered on Ohio and Montana. Tester and Brown are seen as the most vulnerable Democrats. Is your polling suggesting that maybe they aren't actually as vulnerable as previously thought?
Well, they're vulnerable, don't get me wrong, but they're not, you know, they're not losing like Joe Manchin, who dropped out of the race in West Virginia because he was trailing in the polls by 13 points. They're not doing as well as Josh Hawley out of Missouri, who's leading by 10, but there's a little struggle for Ted Cruz down in Texas. The bigger concern I would have is out in Arizona, which is an open seat, and those are tough. Same thing in Michigan. You don't want to just dismiss open seats that the Democrats are going to keep those. But if they get that ticket split, or if there's a momentum towards Biden at the end of the day, we could see the Democrats maybe holding on to the Senate, but obviously losing West Virginia puts it generally at 50-50, so it'll come down to the presidential election if those other seats hold.
Well, I see as you look ahead to Pennsylvania, you've got Casey over McCormick in the Senate race there, 45% to 41%, which is fascinating here. I don't know, when we consider some of the numbers you have on Joe Biden and Donald Trump, if we can just touch the hypothetical for a moment here as well, Spencer, in a state like Pennsylvania, Donald Trump 47, Joe Biden 43, that's supposed to be home turf for Joe Biden. That's
so
a
Joe,
lost race
this cycle,
that happens.
To kind of explain what we're seeing in Pennsylvania, we're seeing it across the country, is 18 to 29-year-olds are voting more like 2000 or 2004 when John Kerry or Al Gore is the nominee, and not like when Barack Obama was the candidate. When Obama's the candidate, the youth vote breaks for the Democrats 2-1, and they were able to carry that in 2016 with Clinton, and to the same extent with Biden in 2020. What the polling this year is showing is that that youth vote is no longer breaking 2-1. It looks maybe by a 10-point lead, and that's what Kerry won the youth vote by in 2004. And in some polls, it's split, and that's what Bush and Gore looked like in 2000. So this realignment of political ideology, particularly with the youth vote, is something that the Democrats are clearly concerned about.
There's also just the question of the undecided voter. Spencer, in that poll that Joe was referencing in Pennsylvania, about 10% of voters said they were still undecided in the presidential contest. Do you actually believe that? And is it going to be a matter of undecided voters actually choosing a candidate, or whether undecided voters choose to vote?
That's exactly it. Who comes out in this election? Remember, in 2020, we had a record turnout. It was during COVID. We had over 155 million people vote, 15 million more than in 2016. Is that 15 million going to come out again, or do they stay home, and where do they not break? And that's something that both parties are going to be working on. It's a state-by-state election here. But that's something that we're looking at, too, as far as the enthusiasm gap that we have. And what's interesting is that while Biden might lack enthusiasm on the top of the ticket, these other Democratic candidates, like Sherrod Brown, as you mentioned, has more enthusiasm. So it's almost as if these down ballots might be able to carry Biden over the finish line in some of these states.
Wow. He's got reverse coattails coming here. Spencer Kimball, it's good to see you, Spencer. Great to catch up. And thanks for sharing these brand new numbers with us here for Ohio. Emerson College Polling Center Executive Director. It's good to know important people, Kaylee. We got the first look at this stuff. It's fascinating what we could learn tomorrow.
Absolutely. It's going to be an exciting primary race, at least down the ballot in Ohio.
We'll see about the top.
Not so much on the top.
Fair enough.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Joe Matthew alongside Kaylee Lyons in Washington, D.C. This is Balance of Power on Bloomberg TV and radio, and we're glad you're with us. As Joe Biden today gets on the phone with Benjamin Netanyahu for the first time in a month. We've talked a bit about the strained relations between the White House and Tel Aviv, of course, over policy in Gaza with a looming invasion, if I can use that term, of Rafah. And it's something that they continue to talk about, coming off of Chuck Schumer's address last week, in which he called for new elections in Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu reacting to what the majority leader had to say. Here he is.
What he said is totally inappropriate. It's inappropriate for to go to a sister democracy and try to replace the elected leadership there. That's something that Israel, the Israeli public, does on its own, and we're not a banana republic.
And we want to turn now to an expert in the Middle East. Joining us now is Hagar Shamali. She's former director for Syria and Lebanon at the National Security Council. She's now founder and CEO at Greenwich Media Strategies. Hagar, always great to have you here on Bloomberg TV and radio. We have gotten a very brief statement from the White House about the call that took place between Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu today. They said they discussed the latest developments in Israel and Gaza, including the situation in Rafah and efforts to surge humanitarian assistance to Gaza. They say a readout is forthcoming. We have not gotten that readout yet. But what do you hope was communicated by President Biden to Netanyahu on this call? And how do you expect that, frankly, any communication from the U.S. president right now is being received on the other end?
Well, there are two sides to this at the moment. So on one hand, what President Biden likely did was he had to do a little bit of damage control following Schumer's statement in particular, because for Schumer to go out and say toward a democracy, toward a country that we are, that is an ally of the United States, that new elections are needed. I'm not one to repeat or parrot Netanyahu's talking points, but that is not the norm for the United States in foreign policy when dealing with a democratic government and a democratic friend in particular. We do say occasionally that elections are needed in countries, but that's where we've seen there to be not free and fair elections, or that there's a dictator, an authoritarian who's not respecting democracy or elections or that kind. So to say in this context is not the way you work with a country like Israel. It's certainly not how you're going to get the Israeli government to cooperate with you, which is Biden's number one goal. So on one hand, he probably had to do some damage control. And on the other, he had to press really hard and say, listen, Bibi, you're putting me between a rock and a hard place. I want to help you. I've been supporting you. We've been very clear about that. But your behavior is going to cause a problem for me on Capitol Hill. And that problem could be very real. It could yield. It could result in halting of aid or less aid or conditional aid. And so therefore, you got to work with me. And we have to work on what's happening in Rafah. This is how we see what's going to happen in Rafah if you invade right now. And it would be catastrophic, as we know. We've talked about it together, about the fact that you have about 1.3, 1.4 million Gazan refugees who've sought refuge there. And without a clear plan, it's hard for the U.S., for us as your friend, to back you up. So that's probably two sides of the conversation he had with Bibi.
This was in the air yesterday at the White House, Hagar, during the St. Patrick's Day celebration. The Prime Minister of Ireland spoke about this publicly while he was with the president, speaking with reporters. He said, quote, "The Irish people have such empathy for the Palestinian people," unquote. And the president said that Taoiseach and I agree about the urgent need to increase humanitarian aid in Gaza and get the ceasefire deal. Is that what led to this phone call this morning when Benjamin Netanyahu is hearing about conversations like these that the president is having openly?
Well, from what I understand from my friends in Washington, this is the situation in Rafah and the humanitarian situation in general in Gaza is top of mind for the Biden administration. This is something that they're actively working on a daily basis. They have people traveling to Israel regularly, trying to press the Israeli government on the need to open more routes, to get more humanitarian aid in, to inspect things faster, to open a maritime route, things of this kind. And so I don't know that that itself was what precipitated this call. I think in general, you have regular communication, but when you see the situation you have now, you have the UN saying that people are in danger of death because of famine, and that it is an emergency, and you've got the US airdropping aid, which we both know is the most inefficient and expensive way to do this, which only reflects how desperate the US government is to try and send some help in, then that's all of that together is likely what precipitated this.
Well, as we think about the efforts to get aid into Gaza, there's also the question of what operations the Israeli Defense Force may still undertake in Gaza. We know that there was another move on a hospital in Gaza City in the last several days, and Rafah, of course, remains a question, as it seems that Israel Netanyahu specifically still is indicating the number one priority is to take out Hamas to the extent that they can. Do we have an understanding, Hagar, of just how close they are to accomplishing that goal?
It's a little difficult because the U.S. has come out, the U.S. officials have said that they believe that the Israeli military has taken out about a third of Hamas's fighters. And Israel has said things that are a bit similar to that, actually. Maybe they inflate those numbers a little bit more. But it's a little bit complicated because on one hand, you have the U.S. saying that, and I, having worked in the U.S. government, obviously, I have a reason to believe when the U.S. comes out with these figures, they don't say that unless they're pretty certain of them. But also, The part that's complicated is the fact that you have Netanyahu coming out and saying that they're at the tail end. And he said that. He said, we're at the very end. We just need to go into Rafah and we need to control Rafah and then we're at the end. And I want to be clear, when he says that, what he means is that they're at the after Rafah, after an operation in Rafah, which would be the last area, city that is not under Israeli military control, that operations might transition to something that's lower intensity, but that the entire war wouldn't end. The effort to undermine Hamas, to go after its fighters, wouldn't end. From what I can see and have studied, it's that you still have those tunnel networks are very active in supporting Hamas and keeping them alive. Apparently their warfare at the moment, while they are definitely on the other end of, they are losing, Hamas is losing, that's very clear. What they've been doing now is retreating in tunnels, and they'll pop out, they'll do an attack, and they'll retreat again. And so that is what the Israeli government is focused on. And the way the Israeli government sees this is they cannot just retreat right now, because if they did, then everything that has happened thus far, without defeating Hamas's ability to launch attacks, to govern Gaza, then everything would have been for nothing. And that's how the Israeli military sees it. That's how the Israeli government sees it. So while I believe Netanyahu in that when he says that the end is near, what he means is that for the high intensity part after Rafah happens. But I don't want to make it sound as though that wouldn't have severe humanitarian consequences, because it would.
Right, sure. Hagar, there were reports a couple of weeks back that Israel was beginning to flood the tunnels beneath Gaza with seawater. Is that how this ends?
Some of them have been flooded with seawater. Some of them, the Israeli government has called in Israeli engineers to also come in and dismantle or destroy some of these tunnels. From what they say, that this won't end until they've destroyed all the tunnels. And I believe that, because they don't invade Gaza often. They haven't been physically in Gaza since 2006, 2005 when they left. And given the threat in October 7 and what they faced, they feel that they must dismantle everything that supports Hamas, that props them up, that keep them living. And you can tell that the U.S. government agrees with that somewhat, because otherwise the U.S. would be calling for an immediate permanent ceasefire right now. And they're not. They're calling for a temporary one because they want to get some hostages released. They want to gain some time so that maybe they can lay the groundwork for a permanent ceasefire. But that permanent ceasefire could only take place if Hamas isn't governing Gaza. So they want to create the space for that in a way that doesn't create such humanitarian devastation and catastrophe. But at the end of the day, both sides agree on the need to defeat Hamas completely. It's just that the U.S. would like to see it in an approach that protects civilians as much as possible.
Hagar, it's great to have you back. Thanks for the insights. Hagar Shamali, now at Greenwich Media Strategies, formerly National Security Council. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.